Desai.
Spend the day with Sai.
From 6 a.m. to 9:30 p.m. on Radio Sai Thursday Live.
Radio Sai Thursday Live.
Offering our most loving pranams at Swami's lotus feet, dear listeners, we welcome you to this week's episode of Afternoon Satsang. As always, this is Prem from Team Radio Sai, and with me is Arvind. And we are here to continue with the Bhagavata Vahini as we are going through. We are still in the initial chapters. The Bhagavata Vahini is actually the exposition that Sage Sukha gives to King Parikshit. But we are still in that point where Parikshit is a little boy and he's about to be crowned, because the point in the story is Lord Krishna has concluded his earthly sojourn. The news has reached the Pandavas. The Pandavas are shaken. They're still discussing amongst themselves what has happened and how it has happened. And they've come to the point where this news has now got to be conveyed to Mother Kunti and the other queens. But before that, they're still wondering about what is their course of action now. And that's when one of the younger brothers, Sahadeva, recollects one of the things which Krishna tells Dhritarashtra, why Pandavas are so dear to him, where Swami would say that Krishna tells that how each limb represents one of the Pandavas and the soul in the body is represented by Krishna. And so Sahadeva says that now that Krishna is left, we are like those corpses which is lifeless, but there is still movement in it, you know, till the death is completely overtaken and the decomposition happens. So they say that whatever we have to do it immediately and proceed towards our next plan of action. So that is the point in the story where we are. And before we continue, we most humbly offer our love at Swami's lotus feet, and I invite Arvind to join all of us. Sairam Arvind.
Sairam Prem. I think we made a mention of this even last week during the satsang, that it is indeed Bhagwan's plan and a real master stroke in a sense, because we are discussing the departure of Lord Krishna around the Aradhana day, you know. So it becomes so easy for us to feel what the Pandavas felt and also understand better what Bhagwan has written in the Bhagavata Vahini about this episode, because we will be in the similar frame of mind and we will be in the same emotions. So again, for all these little things that Bhagwan does, so that we understand better, we improve better and we evolve, I offer our humble gratitude to him. And just as we discussed the departure of Krishna on the Thursday before the Aradhana day, we will be continuing along the same theme as to what next exactly in the Thursday that is coming, succeeding the Aradhana day. A beautiful coincidence indeed. And as you rightly said, Nakula reminds all his brothers, you know how Krishna would say that Yudhishthira is my head, Bhima is the trunk of the body, Arjuna represents the arms, while Nakula and Sahadeva are the two legs. So it is not like it is six different people, but the Pandavas and Krishna are actually one being, where Krishna is the heart or the soul. And so Nakula says that, see, when the heart stops beating or the soul leaves the body, for some time the body is still warm, it still has those characteristics of a living body, you know. That is why if at all we have attended a funeral, we will see that immediately after the death of a person, the person is as alive as he would have been or she would have been. It just looks like the person is in a deep sleep. And with all the Mahapurushas and of course the avatar, the amazing thing was even with Swami also, for days after the actual moment of departure, the body, the vesture that has been taken on by the avatar or the Mahapurush still appears fresh. That's a miracle that has been observed with all the great people, great men of God and the avatars. But even for normal people, as Nakula points out, for a few hours the body is still, whatever, you know, like a living being. And therefore, all the processes, at least in the Indian tradition, you know, we don't have this embalming and all that. What we usually do is, as soon as the death occurs, as fast as possible, before the sunset, If it happens at the night, then before the next day sunset. Before the sunset, we try to finish the crematory rites. I don't know the complete religious or spiritual significance of this, but from a scientific and logical point of view, before the body becomes stiff, it becomes difficult to handle or carry the body, you have to finish it. So Nakula is telling the other brothers that that's how it is. Now we will start getting stiff because we are like the limbs of Krishna and life has left. So it's only a matter of time before we start getting stiff and the decay begins. Now just like for a dead body, all the funeral arrangements are done before it can become stiff or tight like that. It's also time for us not to sit and moan here, but quickly get into action and finish all the responsibilities and duties before we can join Lord Krishna. And it is actually with this statement from Nakula that the midnight conference ends. As we spoke last week, in the middle of the, it's almost late in the night when Arjuna comes with these tidings, these sad tidings that Lord Krishna is no more with us. And what has actually happened is Arjuna has reached Indraprastha, which is the capital under Yudhishthira. But since Hastinapura doesn't have any king, you know, there's no king because all the Kauravas have been vanquished. Yudhishthira and the Pandava brothers would constantly shift between Indraprastha and Hastinapura. So Arjuna, when he reaches Indraprastha, he realizes that his brothers are not there. So those few queens and damsels and ladies and old men whom he has rescued from the barbaric hordes, when he was getting them back from Dwarka, those people, he leaves them at Indraprastha and he has hurried to Hastinapura. So it's late in the night when he has reached. And once this news is broken, throughout the night they have had a conclave. You know, they have been meeting inside. And when Nakula says this, that it's not time for us to mourn and grieve now. We can do all this later. Right now, what needs to be done, we have to do it. So let's go ahead and do it. It is with this that the conclave breaks, and it's almost break of dawn as well. So the brothers walk out of the room, and that is when they have decided that the first course of action would be to inform Kunti and the other queens in the royal chambers. Because let us, we have to keep in mind that nobody so far knows at Hastinapura about the death of Lord Krishna, about Krishna leaving the physical. It's only the Pandavas who know because Arjuna has conveyed to them. So they feel that before the whole kingdom gets to know, let's convey it to Mother Kunti, Subhadra, the others who are there, Krishna's own sister that is. So with that intention in mind, they break the conclave and walk out of the room.
And the interesting point that Swami makes is, they do wonder what would happen when this news is told to Mother Kunti, because, you know, as we explained last week, she's very old. We don't realize that some of these characters must be very, very old. Kunti being something like the, you know, the godmother of the entire clan right now. She's, for all practical reasons, immobile.
To give an idea, Prem, Parikshit is the grandson of the Pandavas.
Right.
So, Kunti is like the great-grandmother. So, a great-grandmother of a teenage king, of a teenage boy. So, you can imagine.
Exactly. And she is the sister of Vasudeva, who is like, you know, Krishna's father. And we know that Pradyumna is one of the people who are there in that battle, who is Krishna's son. And the one who has come along with Arjuna is actually Krishna's great-grandson.
Correct. Right? Vajra.
Vajra is the youngest.
He has reached Hastinapura. Right. That's what we had spoken.
So that's how old she is. And the confusion which arises in their mind is, you know, what will be her response? Is it a good thing to tell them? Is it a good thing to tell all these? You know, how do you break the news to them? This is one of the most saddest things. But the way Swami puts it is so very true. And as you were saying, that the fact that we all have gone through that, we can relate to that in so many ways. The Swami says that the Pandavas think that what does it matter? The worst has already come, right? You know, what worse? Worse than this can happen? You know, at best she might die, at best she might, you know, probably lose mental balance, but none of that is worse than what has already happened. And that's so really true. In fact, I think yesterday we posted an article by one of the devotees about her reflections about the Aradhana event.
So she was on the website, right, on the website.
And she was mentioning this very point that I think after Swami's moving on, she lost her parents. But that was not as painful as the fact of losing Swami. She said that that pain, that the numbness that pain caused of losing Swami was so much more that the other things seems paled in contrast. But then that's what the Pandavas are saying, that nothing worse can happen. So let's not fear anything. Let's just go and break the news.
And as they proceed, you know, another nice point that Swami mentions over here is how time moves very slowly in grief, but joy consumes time very quickly. So even that's what happens for us readers as we read the book, because almost we go through 1 to 2 chapters here, and while in other cases a chapter is possibly covering days, months, in some cases even years, here 2 chapters is just covering one night, you know. So in that sense also time seems to suddenly slow down in times of sorrow. And Swami tells that, and as I was reading this statement, the other statement that Swami often makes in discourses came into my mind, which is, na sukhat labhyate sukham. Swami says, joyful times do not breed further joyful times. And Swami says, it is only sorrowful times that gives rise to times of eternal joy, meaning a joy that is permanent, a joy that cannot be shaken by the ups and downs of life. You know, a kind of state of equanimous joy. Another side thought over here is, Prem, whenever, you know, Swami mentions equanimity, or whenever we hear this term, sukha dukke same kritva, we often think of the state of equanimity like a, I don't know, at least this is what used to come to my mind, like a deadpan state, you know, where there is nothing, there is no joy, there is no sorrow, you are like a piece of wood. That is the kind of thought that comes in your mind. But when we read the way Swami describing the peace, the serenity, the calmness that accompanies equanimity, we realize that equanimity is like a state of a straight line, definitely. But that straight line is not midway between happy and sad. That straight line is right on top there. You are in a state of perpetual joy. And it is not excitement, it is a constant state, but that constant state is a state of great serenity and joy, peaceful. It is not a deadpan, it's not a boring dead state. It's a very vibrant, lively, joyous state, where nothing can touch the joy. I just felt I should clarify this, because I had this misconception. I used to say, I don't want equanimity, because equanimity is boring. Equanimity is dead. Equanimity is a piece of log. But it is not. Equanimity is vibrant. Equanimity is full of joy, and such joy that nothing can touch it. So, if we draw a graph, we have plus and minus. If we think our life is usually plus to minus, going as a sine wave, and if we think equanimity is that central line at zero, we are wrong. Equanimity is definitely a straight line, but possibly not at zero. Possibly up there at 100, you know, at the maximum, plus infinity. So, nothing can touch it. That was a kind of enlightenment that I feel I received. So coming back to, where we were, Swami mentions that in order to get that kind of permanent joy, no, you need dukkham. Because it's only dukkham that makes you introspect. When you're in times of joy, we don't introspect. I think we referred to this even in the previous satsang, using the example of a cricket match, where we don't introspect when we are in a state of joy. It's only a state of sorrow that makes us introspect. And it's only when we introspect are we able to discover the reality and reach that state of equanimity from which nobody can ever shake us. And that's why Swami says dukkham is very important. And also, you know, in the other angle, when we see, when Swami is saying here, time moves slowly when you're in grief, time moves very quickly when you're happy. It also means that for us to introspect when we need time, it's better that we are in sorrow, because in sorrow we get more time to introspect, making more meaningful introspection possible, making us move towards our goal finally. And that is possibly the reason why Swami also narrates the story of how Kunti, when asked for a boon from Lord Krishna, she said, Krishna, please fill my life with difficulties. Because, as Swami says again, na sukhat labhyate sukham, it is only moments of struggle, strife and sorrow that makes us rise beyond this world.
I mean, that's, you know, I was once seeing this program, I think it was in Discovery Science or something, and it was about the science of pain, right? So, I mean, both in the science of pain, it's about how do you manage pain? How do you manipulate pain, right? Because it's all about, they say that when you talk about athletics, when you talk about a soldier in a combat situation, there is no way you can escape pain, right? There is going to be pain, especially if you're a boxer or something like that. There is no way you can escape pain altogether. You can only ensure, you can only train to overcome pain, right? So the whole thing was about how do you mentally train yourself to overcome pain. Mm. And it was quite interesting in that thing. They have a segment where a combat soldier teaches them how do you combat, right? So they have these special knives which they've made. It's actually not sharp, but it's made of some kind of an electrical pulse which comes from the blade. So when you place it on the skin, it looks like there's a cut, but it's actually a very mild shock, right? So they train with that to how do you ensure that you learn how to manage pain.
Oh, so they take the knife and use it on themselves.
On themselves. So how they do it is, like I'm combating with you in that, and the other person is having a knife, and you don't have anything in your hand. How do you fight that person? So he says, see, there are different kinds of pains, especially those pains which lead to fatal injuries are dangerous. So they say you have to train your mind to think that any injury with the knife anywhere near my chest, near the jugular vein, or any such critical point like that, that is real pain. Pains like which comes with a slit in the forearm or on the shoulder or something like that. So you have to train your mind to think that this pain is manageable, it's okay. So when you train your mind to think like that, you will attack in such a manner that all the cuts will come in these places and it's okay. Right? Hmm. So you say that it's a very, very interesting technique by which you, and that happens only by practice, where your mind starts differentiating between different kinds of pains and say this pain is okay, this pain is acceptable, right? So Vivin, when I was going through that, that's precisely what actually happens when you go through the path of spirituality. And there are many pains you look at and you say this is okay. I mean, after all, I'm losing $1 million. You know, after all, a loved one is dying. After all, this is such a small thing. So you start kind of, the meaning of that pain starts paling in your mind. Otherwise, every pain becomes as painful as every other pain. And I think that's what really destabilizes us. And probably that's another way of looking at what the situation is right now, because that huge pain that they've already felt seemed to be giving them a fresh infusion of equanimity. They're already known for their equanimity because nothing mattered to them more than winning the love of Krishna, being dharmic, nothing mattered to them. But this pain seems to be giving them another...
The ultimate test of equanimity.
Right, and it seems to have paled everything else in front of that, right?
Yeah, I mean, I feel if Yudhishthira would have thought back, we discussed again this also in the Bhagavata Vaini of how Yudhishthira was feeling so repentant, so bad that, I have done the Mahabharata war and it is not one Ashwamedha Yaga, I'll have to do three because right. That is the kind of sin I have committed, and he was bemoaning and wailing. I'm sure if Yudhishthira had thought of it, he would have thought that I don't care here, I don't want to do any Ashwamedha Yagas. If only Krishna is back, it's enough.
Right.
That is the kind of a pain that he's experiencing now, and as you said, all other pains of the past or whatever pain of the future you can imagine, you feel that nothing is going to be as painful as this. So, with that they are proceeding towards the queen's chambers. In the meanwhile, Swami also describes as to what's happening with Mother Kunti. Now, Mother Kunti is very eagerly looking forward to the return of her son Arjuna, whom she knows went along with Krishna to Dwarka. And she she misses her son, that is one thing, but more than anything else, she's one of the greatest devotees of Lord Krishna, and she's eagerly awaiting news from Lord Krishna. We can even identify with this when we are in Prashanti and if Bhagwan is in Vrindavan, or when we are in Vrindavan and Bhagwan is in Prashanti, when any of our teachers or our students for Onam or something like that, only a few get to go to the other place, we eagerly await their return because we want to know the news of Swami. That is, so we can identify with how eager Mother Kunti was, but she gets the news that Arjuna has come back in the night, no? In the night, somebody comes and tells her that we have seen Arjuna, one of the messengers. And so she is eagerly expecting Arjuna to come straight to her because that is the practice. She knows for sure that if Arjuna comes to the kingdom, the first thing he'll do is he'll come and seek blessings from me. So she is very excited, thrilled, and she's not able to get sleep. hours pass and Arjuna doesn't come. And you know, this starts getting Kunti agitated. She is first of all in an advanced age, but now she is not able to sleep because she is wondering of why Arjuna might not have come. And in her fear and in her anxiety, she is imagining 100 probable scenarios. All of them are equally frightful or whatever. But the thing is, she is very anxious, excited. She is excited that she will be meeting Arjuna, but anxious as to why he has not yet come. In fact, Swami gives a long list of worries in Kunti's head also, as to why he might not have come. And this is what she is going through, sitting right there.
And she's, I mean, as you're saying, many times Swami would say this, you know, your inner being actually knows that there's something wrong, like what Yudhishthira was saying, even before that news of Arjuna coming and him breaking the news. Yudhishthira was telling this to, you know, Bhima and the others, saying that I'm having this fear that something untoward has happened. I'm sure Kunti, being such a great devotee, she too has kind of sensed it within. But that's what happens with us, you know, when we are actually battling against reality. You kind of try to pile up reasons and try to bury up that truth. That's what she's precisely doing. Because she's saying that, you know, is it that somebody else was mistaken to be Arjuna? Did I get the wrong news that Arjuna has come? Or, you know, is there something like a political crisis for which he's been called away and the brothers are in discussion about it? Or is it that Krishna wanted some counsel from Yudhishthira and he has sent him, and, you know, Arjuna has got to return back immediately after taking Yudhishthira's advice? And all of these things, you know, is running in her mind.
She's even wondering whether, has my son, you know, become a bad son? Has he forgotten his duty towards the mother? All this she's feeling, but she just says, no, don't worry. It's not all this. She's also trying to console herself. She's saying, no, he will definitely come. When the time comes, he will come. Yeah, mostly, as you said, possibly the messenger must have mistaken somebody else who is looking like Arjuna to be Arjuna. So these are all the things going on in her head. And because of this, she doesn't sleep the whole night. She is awake the whole night. And early in the morning, in the Brahma Muhurtam itself, she gets up and she has bathed and she is getting ready. And even as she is getting ready, the thoughts continue to pound in her head. She knows that, see, whether Arjuna has returned or not, that's a different matter. But every night, my other children, that is Yudhishthira, Bhima, Nakula and Sadeva, they always seek the mother's blessings before going to bed. And we saw how even not only mother, Yudhishthira would even seek blessings from Dhritarashtra and Gandhari. In fact, at the end of the day as well as in the beginning of the day. That is how in the beginning of the next day, he finds out that they are not there. So she wonders, it's okay that possibly Arjuna has not returned, but why didn't my other sons come? You know, so that is again starting to trouble her, and she's explaining that possibly Arjuna came back, and as I thought, there was an emergency meeting and that's why they also could not come. Possibly they have been awake whole night, just like how I have been awake. Then since she's ready, she walks out and she goes to the chambers of Subhadra, that is Arjuna's wife, because she feels that if Arjuna has come finally, he should be with his wife, that is Krishna's sister. When she sends a messenger there, she finds out that Arjuna is not there. She also finds out that the previous night, none of the four brothers have even had dinner. Now, this gets her really worried, and even as she is worried like this, the messenger announces that Dharmaja, that is Yudhishthira, along with the brothers, is heading towards her room. So when she hears this, she has both panic and excitement at the same time. It's excitement because she's happy to be seeing them. At least she's assured that nothing has happened to them because they're coming. At the same time, it's, as you said, somewhere in her inner being, she knows that something is amiss and that is making her anxious. So it's in this state that Kunti is in, as Yudhishthira and the brothers have decided that let's break the news, and they're walking towards her room. I think before the news is broken, we'll take a little break here. And so, dear listeners, don't go anywhere. We'll be back after this little break and continue with the Bhagavata Vahini.
Hey Krishna, hey Krishna. Panduranga, 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 Kishora, Sham Gopala.
Kishora, Sham Gopala.
Sham Gopala, Madan Gopala. Jaya Panduranga, Panduranga, Vithala Jaya Panduranga, Panduranga, Hey Krishna. Kishora, Sham Gopala.
Kishora, Sham Gopala.
Sham Gopala, Madan Gopala. Panduranga, 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 Jaya Panduranga, Panduranga.
Welcome back, dear listeners. We are in that point where finally Arjuna comes to the presence of Mother Kunti and he's about to break the news. So the messenger comes to Mother Kunti's room and says that Yudhishthira and Arjuna are proceeding towards her room, and finally she, you know, is calm now that Arjuna is indeed coming, but, you know, as we're saying, that there is a little bit of flutter within.
Yes, that's why, you know, if you see Kunti, the way Swami describes, I'm sure there are multiple questions there. Like, when the moment Arjuna and the Pandavas enter the room, Kunti, though she's eager to hear from them, she doesn't allow them to speak at all. She goes on and on asking questions, and even though she asks questions, before anybody can even answer, she only answers her own question and further asks another question. You know, when you read it, it becomes very evident that she knew that something is terribly wrong and she is trying to delay the inevitable. She doesn't want to hear it. So therefore, she is only filling all the audio space in the room with her own talk. And that's how Swami beautifully describes.
Right, then she starts asking about the parents of Lord Krishna. How are they? Are they also immobile like her? You know, do they also have to be taken care of for every small need? Mm-hmm. She asks that, and then she starts asking about the Yadavas. How are all of them? And then she says that, you know, why are you looking so sick? Mm-hmm. You know, your eyes are swollen. You know, these descriptions are clearly, she's seeing that there's something wrong. She's able to see it on Arjuna's face, but immediately she covers it up by saying that, yes, it's been a long distance, right? You had to come a long way and the travel must have tired you. That's why you look sick. And then she asks, you know, where is Krishna? Doesn't he want to see me anymore? Will I be able to see him once at least before I, you know, discard this life? And I think that is when Yudhishthira steps in and breaks the news.
Yes, I don't remember if it was Yudhishthira or Arjuna.
Yudhishthira breaks the news. He says that because she's constantly, the questions after a short while starts turning towards Krishna and asking how is he, and you know, is he fine, is he going to come, has he come with you, and what is happening there. And that is when Yudhishthira says that, you know, mother, what are you talking about Krishna, that Krishna is no more there.
It's 10 days since he has left and he is no more there. And the amazing thing is the moment Kunti hears this, she lets out a shriek, a kind of wail. It's so filled with pain, and it's almost like she didn't want to hear this, but all the while she was feeling that she's going to hear this. So the moment she hears this, Swami writes it so beautifully, she immediately left in pursuit of Krishna, you know, as if she went to search for the Lord. That's how Swami writes. She gives up her body that very moment. The moment she hears the news, she takes the name Krishna, Krishna, and that's it. She's down. She drops dead on her own son's lap. You know, her head falls onto Yudhishthira's lap and she's gone. And, you know, it is such a shocking thing. So, on one hand, it appears like a very, very sudden thing, but when we read the Bhagavata Vaini, it's almost like she's been preparing for this throughout the night. She almost knows that something is like this is going to happen, and it's all been building up to this moment, and that moment finally arrives like that. But as far as the Pandavas and everyone else is concerned, this has happened so suddenly. The Pandavas have just walked in, and even the attendants and maids who are there, they're all like very shocked, because till this morning she's been asking about Arjuna. She's apparently fine, she's alive, you know, eager, excited, and this next second she's no longer there. In fact, Kunti's departure becomes the reason how the entire palace and later Hastinapura gets to know of Krishna's departure. Because the news spreads that, you know, Kunti has left. And everybody is eager to know why she left. Then the reason comes out, because she heard about Krishna leaving. And at that point in time, you know, there is a lot of grief that the queen mother has left. But the moment that grief strikes the heart, a greater grief strikes everyone's heart, because they know Krishna has left. So it is this kind of a unique scenario where the greatest grief comes accompanied with a greater grief than the greatest grief, just to show that what you're thinking as greatest grief is not the greatest grief. Here is a greater grief, and it's a state of very intense emotion for the entire country, for the entire Hastinapura, for the entire palace.
It's an interesting thing. It's been, I don't know how much can we define what Kunti went through as grief, right? Because, you know, it's very important to look at the character of Kunti in the Mahabharata.
Mm.
I mean, it's so very dramatic, so very beautifully Swami says. She just hears the news. She does not ask for how it happened, why it happened. I mean, she doesn't even ask a second question, is it really true? Right? Just that one word she has heard and she's died. And, you know, look at this woman who's gone through this, her life. She's seen her husband die, right? She's seen her elder son die in the form of Karna. And she's seen all the troubles that the Pandavas have gone through. And nothing has affected her. She's such a brave woman. She's such a strong woman in that sense. She's really the one who has brought up these children in spite of all the conditions they had to be. But after having, you know, faced all those grief with such fortitude, this one news that Krishna has left is enough. You know, I mean, that's the beauty of this character. And that's what Swami says, you know, when Swami would say that the attachment to God is the only attachment which has the ability to make you shed all the other attachments. I think that's what Mother Kunti stands for. It was not that she was completely detached. You know, there are people who, when Swami Mahasamadhi happened, you know, they were all these armchair, if you could say that, philosophers who said, no, Swami was never the body, Swami was this, and yes, they were true. It's not that they were wrong. But somewhere that was the most inappropriate thing to tell somebody who was grieving with the fact that Swami was no more, right? And if you look at that, Mother Kunti was actually attached to the body, if you can say, but her attachment was so supreme that it made her strong for all the other griefs that were coming in her life, and to the point that she asked for more griefs. But this news of Krishna passing away was one thing which was enough, you know, to make her move on.
And then, you know, when this happens, look at the state that the Pandavas are in. You know, Kunti has left, but at this point in time, they are facing multiple tragedies. They are facing multiple tragedies, and it must have been so difficult for them. And it's in this regard that Swami narrates a very important aspect in his discourse. See, this is the point in time when the Pandavas decide that their time has come to march on, so they have to pass on all the duties of the kingdom to the next in line, which is Parikshit, and then they must go on the Mahaprayana, Mahaprasthana, which is there. So, in his own unique way, Swami describes this very poignant yet a beautiful situation, unique situation which has never before occurred, possibly will never again occur, I don't know. That kind of a thing Swami describes in his discourse. I think this is from the discourse in 2002, during the Dasara, I think. Yeah, we'll listen to that and then proceed.
Kunti is feeling very bad because Arjuna did not return from
Dwaraka.
She could get the message that he is coming. And she could know the message that Arjuna was returning, and coming to know that Krishna is no longer there, she went in search of Krishna and breathed no more.
Dharmadu kurchunnadu, Dharmadu thadapaina Kunti Devi talabettindi pranamichindi.
In fact, Kunti rested her head on the lap of Dharmaja and breathed her last.
Dharmadu inga ekkada levadaniki veelledu.
And it's not possible to get up.
Bhimunni pilchadu.
And he called Bhima.
నీవు అరణ్యానికి తగినటువంటి సామగ్రి అంతా నీవు రెడీ చేయమన్నాడు.
యు మేక్ ఆల్ దట్ ఇస్ నెసెసరీ టు గో
అర్జున్ని పిలిచాడు.
He called Arjuna.
Arjuna, నీ కుమారుడికి పట్టాభిషేకమునకు సిద్ధం కమ్ము అన్నాడు.
He said, make every arrangement to coronate your son.
కుమారుడి పట్టాభిషేకం అంతా కూడా బాధ్యత అర్జునికి అప్పచెప్పాడు.
ఇట్ వాజ్ ద రెస్పాన్సిబిలిటీ ఆఫ్ అర్జున టు కారునేట్ హిస్
నకుల సహదేవులంతా అంత్యక్రియలు చేయడానికి వాడు సిద్ధమైపోయినారు.
నకుల సహదేవ should be ready to do obituary rites.
కుంతి దేవికి ఒకవైపున సహజకర్మలు జరుగుతున్నాయి.
ఆల్ దట్ విచ్ హాస్ టు బి డన్ ఇస్ ఆబిచ్యురి రైట్.
అరణ్యానికి ప్రయాణమై పోయితే కర్మలంతా కూడా భీముడు చేస్తున్నాడు.
భీమా వాజ్ మేక్ అరేంజ్మెంట్స్ టు గెట్ ఇన్ టు ది ఎగ్జైల్.
యుద్ధములకు సిద్ధమైనటువంటి యొక్క దీనికంత కుమారుడు బాధ్యత అంతా అర్జునుడు తీసుకున్నాడు.
అర్జున హాస్ టేకన్ అపాన్ హింసెల్ఫ్ ద రెస్పాన్సిబిలిటీ టు కరోనేట్ హిస్ సన్.
ఇది ఎక్కడే గాని భారతంలో ఎక్కడ జరగలేదు.
దిస్ హాస్ నాట్ హ్యాపెండ్ ఇన్ భారత.
ఒకే సమయం లోపల
అట్ ది సేమ్ టైం
ఒక భయంలో అంత్యక్రియలు.
One time obituary.
మరొక విషయం లోపల పట్టాభిషేకము.
Another moment coronation.
మూడవది సర్వసంగ పరిత్యాగము.
And third total renunciation.
తల్లి యొక్క అంత్యక్రియలు.
And obituary.
అన్ని ఒకే దినము ఒకే క్షణంలో జరుగుతూ వచ్చేసేసినాయి.
The last rites, coronation, everything happened at the same moment. Is it possible?
ఎక్కడా జరగదు.
Nowhere it happens.
So that was the discourse you were mentioning. It's the discourse Swami delivered on 14th of October 2002. And Swami has mentioned this many, many times. You know, he would mention this about Lord Rama in the Ramayana too. You know, when things changed so drastically in his life, from being about to be crowned to being sent away to the exile. And now Swami is talking about the devotees who actually express the same quality of that equanimity. And Swami would say this, Swami has spoken about this many occasions, where simultaneously they were able to do so many important tasks because of the detachment they had, you know, because they were detached.
Yes, and I think there are multiple devotees who come to mind. I don't know the details. There is Ram Brahmam, and there is that devotee from East Godavari district. Multiple people who have had this kind of a situation.
I don't know who that person is, but one of my classmates had narrated that incident where this person, I think he was the district president or something, and there was a meeting in his house. The organization meeting was happening in his house. He had a huge house, and most of it used to happen in his house. And that afternoon, suddenly his son-in-law passed away.
His daughter got widowed.
Right. So this husband and wife were so very involved in Swami's activity. They said to each other, come, let's quickly put him in the room and lock up the room. Let the meeting get over and then we'll, you know, let's decide what to do. Right? So they literally did that. That's what they did. And finally, the next day when people asked him, you know, we came to your home for the meeting, but we didn't see your son-in-law. And that's when he opened the, you know, news about how it happened. I think that's what happens, you know, when you attach yourself to something more supreme. The same thing what we saw in Kunti's case. It's different. The flavors are different. The shades are different. The way the equanimity played in her case was different. The way it played in the Pandavaska case was quite different. Right? They were also actually heading towards the same end. You know, Kunti died spontaneously, but they also are going to die. You know, they are also taken the resolve to walk till they shed the body. But to have made that decision and with that equanimity to do all of this, the coronation, the funeral, and to setting right all the affairs before they walk out.
You know, as you rightly said, I feel it is not a difference in their commitment or love for Krishna, but actually being true to their commitment. See, if you look at it from a normal perspective, Kunti could afford to do that, you know. Kunti was a reverential figure, very elderly, and she is there, and I don't think she was involved in the day-to-day affairs of the kingdom or anything. She was just like one goddess venerated and, you know, respectful and blessing sought, that kind of. And so from a practical point of view, she could afford to just leave. But the Pandavas, they are ruling the kingdom, they have responsibility towards the subjects, and that too is a responsibility given to them by God, by Krishna only. In fact, Arjuna, we know, wanted to commit suicide. He wanted to just drown himself in the ocean the moment he got to know about Krishna's departure. And Krishna gives him a meaning, reason to live. He thrusts responsibility on him and he says, you have to do this. You can't simply give up your life. So it's like the Pandavas had some responsibility to complete, because they too had no interest left in living. Why the Pandavas? Later on we will see, even Parikshit is not interested. That little teenage boy, he is not interested in life anymore. In fact, he also wants to just leave along with his great grand uncles. But it's almost like, no, the Pandavas have got some responsibility, they can finish that and leave. Parikshit, you also will come to me, but you have some more responsibilities, you have to finish that, then only you can come. It's almost like that, it feels. So whether it's Parikshit or the Pandavas or Kunti, all of them have this intense love for Krishna. And as you rightly said, depending on the desha, kala and paristhiti, on the time, the circumstance and the place they are in, and the stage of life they are in, depending on that, that love for Krishna expressed itself. And for Kunti, it was she leaving immediately. In the case of the Pandavas, it was them deciding on coronating Parikshit and then completing the funeral of Kunti and then doing the Mahaprasthana. In the case of Parikshit, it was about setting things right in the kingdom, making the kingdom flourish, and then, you know, give up his body while contributing the Srimad Bhagavatam itself for mankind. So all had their roles. It is not as if one loved Krishna more than the other, and all performed their roles to perfection. But what is common between all of them, as you rightly said, is their intense love for Krishna. That intense love for Krishna makes them do whatever possible. They are detached from the world. They are ready to do the most tough steps. They are ready to take the toughest steps which otherwise would not have been possible, and all that becomes possible because of their intense attachment to Krishna.
And absolutely, and I mean, you can also imagine the state the palace itself would have been in, you know, in the royal enclosure itself would have been in, because all of them are grieving, right? Like even in the case of Swami, there was this entire ashram, everybody was grieving, but everything had to go on because, you know, we were going to face probably the biggest challenge of having a huge number of people coming in a very short time, in a very unplanned manner. You know, you can be prepared for a 90th birthday, you can be prepared for an 85th birthday, but completely unprepared, the
for
ashram
a 24th
was, right,
April.
It's going to be flooded by people. And that was a time when everybody in the ashram had to step up and, you know, really work and put aside that personal grief, which would have been so very difficult. In fact, you know, I always, when I was sitting there in the Kulanthal, I looked at all of you who were working in Radio Sai then, you know, Sai Prakash and you, and I was wondering, how are you people all working, you know, to be able to go about and setting up the camera and taking photographs and videos. You know, in a sense, we all felt so much sympathy for all of you, because you don't even have the time to grieve, you know. Mm-hmm. Swami has not given you enough time to sit down and really weep your heart out, really.
No? And, you know, I really feel that however we are or whatever we are, once the Lord gives the task, He also gives the strength, because like you said, you were wondering, I myself look back and wonder how did I go about doing it, and I feel it is simply Swami's grace, otherwise it was not possible. And I'm sure it was the same for the Pandavas. They also were convinced that it is Krishna's grace that Kunti left instantly. And in fact, Yudhishthira tells it also. He tells it to all the people that don't grieve over Mother Kunti because she is very blessed. She is very blessed that the moment she heard, she went on. It is we who are unfortunate that our hearts are still beating when the heartbeat has gone. Our bodies are still alive when the soul has already left. You know, in that way he is bemoaning his fate. But I am sure it is only Krishna's grace that gave strength even to the Pandavas to hold on and not let go of the body and so that they can finish their responsibilities. And it is only the grace of Krishna that Parikshit could do what he did. So I feel in that sense, you realize that you are not the doer at all. You are just the witness and God is the doer of everything. He is the one who gives strength. He is the one who, whatever, you know, takes away strength in the, as in the case of Kunti. And we, as you, you know, it's very, similar in Swami's case also because the person who comes to my mind is Dr. Savitramma, who was running the Bangalore General Hospital. And in my own family, one or two people who had so much love for Swami, a couple of them, you know, they didn't even get to know that Swami had left because a day or two before Swami left, they left their physical body. You know, it was very amazing and I felt blessed they are because they never got to hear the news that Swami is leaving. And in the case of, that was the same in the case of Savitramma, and after Swami's departure, there were a few other such stalwart devotees who left immediately and one felt envious of them. But it is like that. They were all given the blessedness that Kunti was given. And then there are a few other elders who apparently stayed on for just a little more time. They completed some duties and then they stepped back from active roles. And again, I feel those are the devotees who have been given blessings like the Pandavas. And then there are many possibly, many Parikshits. Many Parikshits and so many more Parikshits coming on and on. Possibly who have never seen Krishna much, who have never interacted with Krishna much, but they have intense love for Krishna. That is, they have intense love for Swami. And they feel, why is it that we have come at such a wrong time? But just like Parikshit got the grace of Krishna, that kind of grace is being given to those people. So ultimately when we are able to see from a whole pitch, holistic point of view, it is Swami's grace on each one at different, in different ways. But yet, that grace is exhibited and expressed by each devotee in a different manner based on his or her position in life, stage in life, responsibilities in life.
And that's the admiration which all the citizens are having when they're looking at Yudhishthira and his brothers. Mm. The way they're going, because you know they know that the passing away of Krishna means to them more than anybody else. Because you know they are the ones who've been so very dear to Krishna, physically been close to Krishna, and Krishna has gone to know it. You know, there are so many stories which Swami would narrate about the kind of fond affection which Krishna showed. We loving Swami is probably the most natural thing because he's the most lovable person. But the fact that Swami had a certain amount of, you know, special affection for some people, it makes that bond even more special. And that is the case with the Pandavas, you know, where Krishna was, the story of him lifting Draupadi's slippers in order to help them come across a certain difficult situation.
Falling at
the feet of Roma Rishi, and he saying that I will pick the leaves after the guests eat during the yajna, the Rajasuya yajna. And all of this showed that Krishna endeared himself to the Pandavas. And when these citizens look at the Pandavas go about their work in such a clinical manner, in such a detached manner, all their reverence for them only grows multifold. They say that only the Pandavas are capable of doing this. You know, only the strength, as you're saying, that strength which Krishna has imbibed in them, that is what is making them act in the manner they're able to act. And precisely after all this, when they say Parikshit rule the kingdom, they will all realize it's the same strength. You know, it's not this Parikshit who is doing this, but it's that grace of Krishna who's, you know, making him do whatever he is able to do.
I was reminded of a statement that, you know, our Mr. Ajit Popat, mm-hmm. he calls himself the puppet, and it is Swami who has named him as puppet. And I think recently he released a book also called The Divine Puppeteer. So he often used to make one statement, and he said that this is what Swami told him. Whenever he came to report to Swami about the activities or whatever, happy or sad, good or bad, whatever, whenever he would say it, Swami would many times respond by saying, puppet, what has to happen will happen, what needs to be done needs to be done. So he said he would say that this statement actually gave him equanimity and strength to go about, you know, not to get over excited with joy, at the same time not to get depressed and put off. So I think that's a very beautiful statement for us to remember also. What has to happen will happen. What needs to be done needs to be done. So what has to happen is not in our hands. It will happen. I think the what needs to be done is definitely in our hands, because it involves efforts. And that is also, I feel, another way of stating the famous Bhagavad Gita statement of Karmanya Vadikaraste Ma Faleshu Kadachana. The results are not in your hand, the efforts are in yours. So you have to do results, you have to make efforts. It is completely yours. You can't give up efforts. You only have to give up the result of your efforts, the fruit of your efforts. In the same way, what has to happen is not in our hands, and what has to happen will happen irrespective of whether we put in efforts or not. You know, what has to happen is going to anyway happen. So with us, without us, in spite of us, it is definitely going to happen. But how we react to that, how we respond to that, the efforts we put in that, that is what determines our own progress, our growth, our peace of mind, our joy, our connection with God. And therefore, that statement is a beautiful thing I was reminded of, and I think we can keep that in mind. I'll repeat it once more, final time. What has to happen will happen. What needs to be done needs to be done. So when something happens, our response to that should be, what is it that has to be done? And let us do that now. That's precisely what Yudhishthira did, because as Swami says, with his mother's corpse on his lap, mother's dead head on his lap, he's directing one of the brothers to go, he's telling Arjuna, go and arrange for the coronation of your grandson, of your direct grandson, that is Parikshit. He's telling Bhima, go and make preparations for our Mahaprasthanam, because we will be walking, we will be relinquishing everything, we will be sacrificing everything, and as renunciants we'll be walking. And then he tells his younger brothers, Nakula and Sadeva, please go and prepare, make arrangements for the funeral of the mother. So three kind of events, one happy, one sad, one neutral, all three happening at the same time. And Yudhishthira could possibly do that simply because he was following this dictum of Swami, where what has to happen will happen, what needs to be done needs to be done.
And I think we'll be able to do that, going back to the same thing, with when there is equanimity. You know, what has to happen will happen comes with the idea that, you know, whatever happens is for my good. That's what Swami would say, is the source of equanimity and the source of surrender itself, right? And I think it all comes back to that. There's that beautiful story, right? It's a very popular story. It's been animated and all that, where there is this farmer who has an old horse, right? And he has a small family in the village, his wife and his son, and there's this old horse which he has, which he uses for his cart to take his produce to the market. When one day the horse runs away, so all the neighbors come and tell him how unfortunate your horse has run away, right? Mm-hmm. So he says, who knows, let's see, it may be good, may not be good, right? So the next day the horse comes back with a younger horse, right? It brings a younger horse which is very swift. So now the neighbors come and tell him, oh, you're so lucky, you've got a second horse. He says, who knows, let's see, right? So the third day, what happens is the son gets onto this young horse and tries to ride it, and it's a swift horse, so the son falls down and breaks his leg. So again the neighbors come and say, oh, unfortunate, your son has broken his leg. So he says, who knows, let's see. So the day after that, the army people come to recruit youngsters into the army because there's a war which is impending. So seeing this fellow who's having a broken leg, they leave him and go and they take the other youngsters in the neighborhood. So the neighbors again come back and say, how fortunate, actually it was good that your son had broken his leg because he's escaped. So again the farmer says, who knows, let's see. So it is not like he says that this is bad and that is good. He's not even elated when something good happens. He says, let's see. I think that state of readiness to see what is coming is what will give you the equanimity. And I think that's what's happened. Okay, this has happened. Fine. This is what is willed to happen. Now what is the next thing to do? And that equanimity to do what has to be done will come when you really connect to God. And Swami says you'll connect to that through the act of surrender. I remember one of our juniors narrating an incident about his mother who runs a company. She's the CEO of a company, and I think there was a fire accident in their office building.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole thing was getting gutted, and she had no clue what to do, right? And she was like so panicky. And finally what she did was she went to the terrace of the building, and she started praying to Swami. She said, Swami, I have no idea what to do. You know, give me composure. I need to do a lot of things. So give me composure. And she said, in the next 2 minutes, some kind of calm descended on her, and she went about clinically doing whatever had to be done. She called up the right people, she called up the right, the ambulance and the whatever had to be done in the next 15 minutes, which was so critical for saving the lives of people in that building. She said she did all of that because a certain amount of acceptance and equanimity came because of that prayer she did in that terrace. I think that's what having somebody like Swami in our life can do. And that is the best way to utilize the presence of God in our lives. If you're not doing that, then probably you're missing out the best part of having God in your life.
On that note, I think, dear listeners, we'll take another quick break. On the other side of the break, we will continue with the coronation of Parikshit and the Mahaprasthana of the Pandavas. So don't go away anywhere. We'll be back after this little break.
गिरिधर गोपाला हे गिरिधर गोपाला हे गिरिधर गोपाला गोपाला हे गिरिधर गोपाला हे गिरिधर गोपाला के प्रभु गिरिधर नागर मीरा के प्रभु गिरिधर नागर सूरदास के श्याम मनोहर सूरदास के श्याम मनोहर भक्तों के सत्य साई मनोहर सत्य साई मनोहर गिरिधर गोपाला हे गिरिधर गोपाला हे गिरिधर गोपाला प्रभु गिरिधर नागर सूरदास के श्याम मनोहर भक्तों के सत्य साई मनोहर सत्य साई मनोहर गिर
गिरिधर गोपाला, हे गिरिधर गोपाला, हे गिरिधर गोपाला।
Welcome back, dear listeners, and as we left you behind before the break, the coronation of Parikshit has been decided and they want to get it done and over with as soon as possible, because as we described right in the beginning, for the Pandavas it's like the body that is decaying with after the life has left, and very fast all the rites and rituals have to be performed. The funeral in that sense has to be performed. So therefore they feel that as soon as the funeral of Mother Kunti is completed, immediately after that the coronation of Parikshit has been decided, and it will be a simple ceremony. So therefore, unlike other emperors who have been crowned, you know, where all the vassal kings, everybody in the empire is invited, elaborate preparations are made, like we saw how preparations were made for the Ashwamedha Yagna itself. How everybody was called, everybody had been given separate enclosures, their accommodation, their food, everything is planned to such a great extent. Here there was no time for all that. It would take a lot of time before everybody could travel, and therefore, since they had decided that the coronation has to happen immediately, immediately meaning that very day. Imagine early in the morning in the Brahma Muhurtam, the Queen Mother has passed away, her funeral has been completed, now you are doing the coronation. Therefore, it was a simple ceremony and everyone in the empire was not invited at all because there was no time to do all that. And even in the ceremony, it was a very solemn one. Usually, it is a ceremony that's filled with enthusiasm and joy and eagerness, celebration, because the king is, and a new emperor is ascending the throne of Bharata. But here it was a very solemn ceremony, and as Swami, as Bhagavan writes it poignantly, everybody in the Darbar hall were in tears. Even Yudhishthira, who was now placing the crown onto the head of Parikshit, was in tears. And Parikshit, onto whose head the crown was being placed, he was also in tears. So it was a tearful anointing ceremony that took place, and Parikshit was crowned as the emperor of the entire empire.
And remember, Parikshit is a very, very small kid even at this point, and you know, he breaks down. He doesn't resist the whole thing in the first place, but then after that he breaks down and he says, no, why are you doing this to me? He falls at the feet of Yudhishthira and he tells that it's unfair that you're, you know, placing such a huge responsibility on me. And you know, at this point, I think when you read the arguments, you really don't, you get the feeling, are really the Pandavas doing the right thing?
Exactly.
You know, as you're saying, that the roles, the devotion to Krishna played in the life of Kunti was different from that of Pandavas and Parikshit. I don't know how that differentiation has really arrived at. You know, in what way were Pandavas right in saying that we have to go and Parikshit, you have to rule? Right? You know, that's very difficult to say. But I think even for the other Pandavas,
you know, Prem, I feel, you know, when you say it's difficult to say, it's also, even I felt the same. And I, when I looked into my own heart, I felt it's also possibly because we feel to some extent like that about Swami. You know, I really felt like that. When Swami left, the first thing that came into my mind was Kunti only. And I was thinking to Swami, Swami, why couldn't I have been like Kunti or like the Pandavas? Why am I supposed to be taking on the role of Parikshit? You know, it's like these people, they just died for you, Swami. They died for Swami. And here, after you have left, I'm supposed to live for you. You know, it feels like, and I feel possibly that is the reason why both of us are not able to understand, because somewhere in our heart, we are still trying to come to terms with this question as to why Swami, why was this, why, you know, why this difficulty, because what was there is something that can never be equated with anything else in the universe, and once, as you rightly said, once that is gone, what else matters? So I think that is possibly the reason why when we look at this, we feel it's very unfair for Parikshit, because somewhere in our heart also, each one of us, possibly every devotee, every youth member who is coming to Swami now, feels that that kind of responsibility that Parikshit had thrust upon him is being thrust upon us without any of the privileges that the Pandavas and Kunti enjoyed.
But the thing is, you know, if you look at the Pandavas, at least the other brothers, we know that throughout the Mahabharata, they all had their own opinions. You know, it's not like all of them thought the same way. They all had their own opinions of how to react to the Kauravas, and how do you react every time they were cheated. Bhima would have his own opinion, Arjuna would have his own opinion, but eventually they will all toe the line which Yudhishthira is wanting them to walk on. That's because they knew that he's the moral compass. Finally, what he says is the dharma, because you could really bank on him. You know, there could be 100 million options in front of you, but he'll choose the option which is your dharma for that moment. And that is why I think when Yudhishthira says that this is what we have to do, and they also know that this is what we want to do, they know that this is the right thing to do. And that will not come with a day's, choice to be made. You know, when you're put in a situation, it will not come spontaneously. It comes with years of practice. And that is why Dharmaraja is able to make that right choice at that point. How much ever it might appear illogical to me or to you, and when we look at it, the fact that he has stuck to dharma all through his life, in all the vicissitudes of life, and when many, many difficulties have come through, you can be absolutely sure that when that day when he made the choice, it was the right thing to do. It was the most dharmic thing to do. And that's why all the Pandavas knew, all the great intellectuals in the court knew that what they were doing is right, even though they were all arguing with him with probably the faint hope that he would listen to them. Even Parikshit knew that they were doing what was their dharma, and they were asking him to do what was his dharma, because they're not like the blind king Dhritarashtra, who would give others a command which was suitable to them. They would always give the command which was the right thing to do, right? And that's why probably none of them are able to garner enough strength to tell them to not do what they've decided to do.
But Parikshit tries, he pleads ignorance and childishness. He says, I am just a child. I have been playing all this while, and suddenly you are now putting me on such a responsible thing, on such a responsible throne, position. How will I do that? Probably if not cancel their Mahaprasthana, I think Parikshit is at least trying to delay, stay on for an year or two, guide me along.
Exactly.
He's saying that, if you can't do that, then let's entrust this kingdom to the ministers. They will take care. I will come with you, because I'm a child. I still depend. I will come with you. I will eat the same roots and tubers that you're eating. Let me come along with you. And when he says this, I think because the Yudhishthira has decided Mahaprasthana, and possibly Parikshit is not able to understand the term Mahaprasthana.
Right.
For our own information, Mahaprasthana is when you start walking towards the north. That is supposed to be Godwards. That's why even Swami says that during Shankranti, the sun moves northward, means it is a time to move our thoughts towards God. So somehow in the north, the Himalayas, they have been considered in India as the divine abode. And so you start walking northwards in Mahaprasthana, and you walk and walk without stopping for eating, sleeping, drinking or anything. You walk till you drop dead with exhaustion. That's it. That is Mahaprasthana. So when Parikshit is telling that I will come and sustain on the same roots and tubers, sleep in the same ground that you are going to sleep, I think Yudhishthira would have also felt compassion that, child, it's not what you're thinking. Mahaprasthana is not about sannyasa yoga, living in the forest as an ascetic. So he goes to console and he tells Parikshit, don't think you're weak. In a lion's family, only a lion is born. So he's trying to tell him that, Parikshit, you have all the qualities, all the wisdom, all the things that you see in the others in the family. You are the descendant of that same family, so you're also bestowed with all that. Because in a lion's family, only a lion cub is born. So therefore, you are a lion, and you have to now stand up and roar, And therefore, he tells that, take all these Brahmins, take all these ministers whom you are telling that I should place as ruling in your stead, no? Take them to be like your guides and parents also. With their guidance and this, rule on the kingdom. Don't be weak like this because you're a lion. But Parikshit is not consoled.
And then Parikshit goes on to say that, why did you have to really save me? Because we know the eventful birth that finally gives Parikshit to the world. He says, why did you have to save me? You could have allowed me to die in the womb of my mother. And he says, I've never seen my father. You know, he's born to Abhimanyu after the death of Abhimanyu, right? He's born and he's saying, I've never known the love of a father. I've been brought up by all of you. And now suddenly, you know, it's a time for me to spend with my friends and in fun and frolic. And you're entrusting such a huge thing and you're all going away. It's not like I've been given the duty and I have the, you know, the advantage of the counsel of all of you. You all are leaving. He says, why did you even have to do this to me? He says, nothing. Even now you go ahead. Why don't you just draw your sword, you know, off with my head, and then you can carry on with whatever you've made up your mind with. And at this, really, everybody in the court are breaking down listening to these words of this little boy. Arjuna comes forward and, you know, how our elders would do, and you say something really stupid like that, they would come and cover your mouth, saying that, no, don't speak nonsense like that. In the same manner, Arjuna covers his mouth and embraces him and says, son, don't speak like this. And then Arjuna tells him that, you know, even we were like that. Even we have not had the love of our father. And we were taken care of by our uncle. We finally, you know, reached the palace. And he said, we've all done all this so that at the end of it, there should be a virtuous one on the crown taking care of this kingdom. And that is precisely the reason we're putting you, and this is your duty, and this is actually, you know, you're going to lift on your shoulders the burden of all our duties, and that's why you should not give up.
You know, all said, Prem, when I read this, I was totally on Parikshit's side. You know, I somehow felt that this argument doesn't hold water. Arjuna telling that, you know, I grew up without a father's love, so therefore why should I? Means it's almost like we know that Arjuna had lost his father, and the Pandavas had lost their father, and they grew up without a father. But in this case, it's not like that. It's different when my father is dead versus it's different when my father is choosing to leave me and go off. So, I don't know, as you said, we have our own feelings in our heart. When I read this, I just felt it's a very unfair remark to make like this. And possibly, you know, this would have played even on Parikshit's face. Because when Arjuna is saying this, he's seeing that Parikshit is nowhere near getting convinced. And he knows that his words are not soothing or anything. That's why he turns to all the Brahmins and all the ministers who are assembled. And he actually pleads with them. Arjuna says, come on, you speak up. Why are you standing mute and dumb? Here is your king, your emperor, speaking things that he should not. Isn't it your duty? Isn't it your right? Isn't it your obligation to correct him, console him, give him good advice, give him sage counsel? You know, I think that's where the word sage counsel has come, because sages used to give counsel in those days. So he's saying, is it not your duty to give sage counsel? Come on, don't stand mute. He's like egging on everybody else also to speak. But sadly, you know, everybody is mute. Because what do you say in such scenario? Everybody is going through multiple throes in their own heart. So what do you speak? So everybody remains mute, and I think it's at this point in time that Kripacharya speaks on behalf of all the ministers and the Brahmins and all the... And when we say Brahmin here, again, it's not a caste. Swami defines Brahmin as a person who is engaged in the quest of Brahman, which is one who is on a spiritual quest. It is to signify that all the ministers were people who had spirituality as their primordial goal. Such people are only selfless enough and noble enough to rule and be advisors to the king. So it is such people, such spiritual giants. But even such spiritual giants are struck dumb and mute. And it is finally when Arjuna is almost pleading with all of them that Kripacharya, on behalf of all of them, he speaks.
Right, and he says that, you know, what can we say, that this moment is so very poignant and so very gloomy that all of us are lost in our own grief. And as we said, you know, the whole place, all of them are reeling under the death of Krishna, of course, and that of Mother Kunti, and now this fact that Pandavas are going to leave them forever. So it's, I mean, their status is nowhere near admirable. And he says that in the midst of all this, you can't expect us to console Parikshit, because we are actually on his side. We are feeling the same way, and that's what Kripacharya says, that, you know, recall what is taken for you to become the kings of this land. the Mahabharata war, which has caused a river of blood to flow. And he says that, I mean, you had to go through so much of travail to come to where you are right now.
And not only you, all of us.
All of us. And he says that you have not even ruled for 100 years. That's an interesting thing. He says not even for 2 centuries you have ruled. That's what Kripacharya says. I mean, which shows the longevity of life in that era.
Which and also shows the kind of devastation that was wreaked in the Mahabharata war.
Right.
You feel that after such a kind of a killing and mass, you know, mass scale death of so many people, you definitely, the Mother Earth definitely deserves some 200 years of peace. That's what you feel.
Right. And that's what's happening. I mean, he's saying that you have not even ruled for so many years, at least for 100 years, at least for 80 years, that's what he says, which means they have ruled for quite some time. I think maybe 75 years. I think 75 years or something.
I'm not sure.
But there's a considerable number of years that they've ruled, 60 years. From our point of view, but from that age point of view, and as you're saying, the devastation which has led to this victory, from that point of view, it's not quite remarkable. So he says that you are leaving so abruptly. It's not acceptable to any of us, but of course it's your decision and we really can't do anything about it.
One point that we can notice in the world is, I have seen it in my own family, is when suddenly death occurs, it seems to occur in groups, you know, like you see 4 people dying within a span of a year or 5 people. Scientifically also it makes sense, because it's like you see all your classmates at one point in time are getting married. And you wonder, what is this, man? Everybody is getting married. It's not like that. A certain age is reached, everybody gets married. A certain age is reached, everybody is having children. And there are a few people who get married and get children earlier than the others. There are a few laggards who get married and get children after the others. But generally, a large section is in the same. So in the same way, in a family also, when some person of one generation dies or leaves, so many multiple seem to leave. And it happened in my family also, not multiple in the sense, 2 or 3 people in the span of 1 year. And there was a kind of sorrow, you know, suddenly you see all people whom you have lived with 30 years, 40 years leaving. At that point in time, a child is born. Mm-hmm. You know? When a child is born, suddenly, you know, that everybody looks at that child as a kind of a redeemer, you know. You get, it's like when all the trees are falling, you get a tender shoot and you want to spend all your energy and focus on that shoot so that it will grow up into a tree. And you find a kind of, at the lowest level, if I can put it, you find a distraction. You know, and it's a very positive and healthy distraction, because on one side you have death, on the other side there is life. So life is a great distraction from death.
Mm-hmm.
And it usually happens that in such families, when there is a multiple death going on, a child comes and all the focus turns there, and that is one way to overcome the grief of the death.
Mm-hmm.
That is what Yudhishthira tries to do here. Everybody's focus is now on Krishna leaving, Kunti's death, the Pandavas leaving. So in that scenario, Yudhishthira tries to distract or deviate everybody's attention and focus onto life now. So he says, now Parikshit is the king. And not only Parikshit, he says, we have got Vajra. Vajra is the person whom we read about, who had come earlier to Hastinapura, the only survivor among the Yadavas. He is actually the son of Aniruddha. Aniruddha, who is the son of Pradyumna. Pradyumna, who is directly Krishna's son. So here we have a descendant of the Pandavas, that is Parikshit, and a descendant from the Yadava clan, from Krishna, that is Vajra. And Yudhishthira says that Parikshit is being crowned at Hastinapura. We crown Vajra as the king of Dwaraka. And these two will now continue the kind of relationship the Pandavas had with Krishna. They will be together in times of distress, in times of success. They will be powerful allies. And, you know, therefore, not a single coronation, but a double coronation happens. The coronation of Vajra and the coronation of Parikshit. And it feels as if Yudhishthira is trying to shift everyone's focus and energy from what is leaving and what is gone to what is coming and what should be focused on. So with that intention in mind, he announces both of these coronations.
Right, and you know, interestingly, the point which Kripacharya raises, that you know, you've fought so hard, you've defeated the forces of evil, and you really want that, you know, we always end our stories with, you know, the happily lived ever after. because we are so interested in that ever after. We don't want, we forget that just like evil also ends, good also ends. And that's the interesting thing. I think in Swami Sandeha Nivarani, Swami says that. Swami speaks about the subtle Ramayana, which we spoke of when we spoke about the Ramakatha Rasamayana. Swami also speaks about the subtle Mahabharata. And in that, very beautifully, Swami says, the city of Hastinapura, Swami says it stands for Astinapura, which means the city of bones, which is the human Asti. Body. Asti means bones, Swami says. So Astinapura is actually the body. And there you have two forces fighting against each other, the good and the evil. And always evil thoughts are more, Swami says. And that's why there are 100 Kauravas, there are only 5 Pandavas. And the 5 Pandavas, of course, represent the human values of Satya, Dharma, Shanti, Prema. And Swami very beautifully and very poignantly points out that the Mahabharata will end only when the evil force are defeated and even the good qualities leave the Astinapura.
You go beyond.
Right. Only when this human nature becomes qualityless or attributeless, becomes gunatita, that is when the story actually ends. So even in the subtle Mahabharata, just like the subtle Ramayana, the story cannot end even until even the good qualities slowly sublimate into absence.
You know, I know the time is already 1:55 and time for us to conclude. But when you said that happily ever after, I just feel a tragedy or a joyous ending in a movie or in a play or anything or in life itself just depends on where we decide, what time frame we decide to take.
Right.
Because in the Mahabharata also, if we pick up a time frame from say the Kauravas plotting against Pandavas till the disrobing of Draupadi in the open court, if we take only that as a story, that is definitely a story. But in that story, everything seems to be violated. You know, it is like it was terrible ever after, no use of being good. It's like that. But you have to remember that the story doesn't end there. You go ahead. And when you go ahead, you know, you see what is happening in the Mahabharata war, you feel, wow, good triumphs. This is awesome. But you're feeling it is awesome because you think the story ended there. Go ahead and see how Draupadi's children are massacred. And everybody is dead. You think, what is the point of this war? It's all useless. It's all worthless. It's all bad. It's terrible. Yes. If you decide that that is the ending, it's terrible. But you go ahead. So you see, it's a never-ending process. Just like the story you said. If you take the end of the story where the horse runs away, it's a tragedy. If you take the point where the horse gets a young horse and comes back as the end of the story, then it's a happy ending. If you take the next part, then it's a tragedy. Then you take the next part. I think that is the nature of this dual world where happiness, as Swami says, a pleasure is an interval between two pains. And it keeps coming like that. So it looks like that is the nature of the world. And deciding on where we put our full stop, the story is a tragedy or the story is a victory. So there's actually no such good or bad, happy or sad. And I think the purpose of our life is to realize that. And we hope that by doing all this, by following Swami, yes, going through the story of the Bhagavatam, which inspires, which touches our heart, that finally a point in time will come where we will be able to transcend the gunas and become gunatita that Swami wants us to.
Exactly. I think that is the most important thing which we always forget, that you cannot find conclusion in this world. That's what Swami would say. You know, Swami would tell that beautiful analogy of a man who walks into a military hotel and he orders for idli sambar. And the server comes and laughs at him. He said, haven't you seen the board outside? And Swami would say, similarly in the world, there is a board which says,
Anityam asukham loke.
Pedda board pettaru akada, Swami would say, outside this world.
Meaning and the world is anityam, impermanent, asukham, filled with sorrows.
Right, which means you can never find long-lasting happiness in the world. And you come into this world and say, where is that anityam asukham? You know, where is anitya sukham? Where is that eternal happiness? The truth is that eternal happiness is not to be found in the world, but within what you do in this world, you have an opportunity to head towards that nitya sukham, which is beyond this world. And every story, every epic is actually meant to teach that very lesson.
On that note, dear listeners, we take leave of you for another fortnight, because the next fortnight we'll be going back to Bhagwan Sajan to Africa. And after that, we will continue with the Bhagavata Vaini. We hope that you are enjoying it as much as both of us here. As always, feedback is welcome. You can write to us at listener@radiosai.org. We offer the segment at the lotus feet of our beloved Swami and express our gratitude to him for this opportunity. We will end with a bhajan, on the other side of which there will be the segment Love to Love.
Thank you.